This episode of the Backside Ground Balls podcast is presented by The Performance Academy. For all of your athletic training needs, train with purpose at The Performance Academy. TPA houses a number of training resources from private baseball and softball instruction to team sports performance classes. Utilize advanced technologies like Output Sports, HitTrax, and TrackMan to take your game to the next level. On top of our elite staff and advanced technological capabilities, be a part of the TPA family and take advantage of the many resources our facility has to offer. Want to go to a game? How about a concert? How about going to see classical music? Whatever you're into, there's only one place to get your tickets. And thankfully, we are partnered with SeatGeek, the essential resource for live events. For any of your ticket needs, make sure you go over to SeatGeek.com and use the code BACKSIDEGROUNDBALL to receive $20 off your first purchase. Again, that is SeatGeek.com. Promo code Backside Ground Ball to receive $20 off your first purchase. We are super excited to announce that we are now partnering with Routine Baseball. For all of your clothing needs, athleisure, the sickest baseball gear you can get. We're talking hoodies, shorts, sweatpants, sunglasses, hats, any baseball style you can imagine, Routine Baseball has it, and we are now partnered with them. All you got to do is go to routine.com/backsideground ball. That's a mouthful, so I'm going to say it again. It's routine.com/backsideground ball and check out all the different options they have. You will receive 10% off your order today. One more time, routine.com/backsideground ball and get 10% off your order today.
Welcome back to the Backside Ground Balls podcast. Super excited to be back here on the pod. My name is Trevor Powers, and I am joined by my co-host, Dan Galati. To everybody that listened to the last episode, we apologize about the technical difficulties. For whatever reason, it was not coming in on my end and my audio, so I couldn't hear what Dan was saying. Then I went to edit the podcast, and I could hear everything Dan was saying. So what we're going to try to do is, if that happens this time, I'm going to become like John Boy. I'm going to read Dan's lips, and we're just going to basically play a game where I'm just going to guess what he had to say and also hope it's not on the delay so we're not waiting for an extended period of time, and we're going to see how it rolls. Dan, how does that sound?
Can't wait to see how this episode goes off the rails and where we fall off technically. You would think 150 some odd episodes in, we'd have this ironed out, but here we sit, and who knows? Are you a Scottie Scheffler fan?
Yeah, love Scottie. He seems like the ultimate good dude. Just seems genuine. Doesn't seem like he didn't come up with a ton of fanfare, I guess, when he was young. Like, he wasn't like a prodigy, and he's just like a dude. And he seems like a good person, which is all I genuinely care about athletes, is are you a good person, and then I'll root for you.
Yeah, I really think I'm in the minority. Something about him rubs me the wrong way. I don't disagree with what you just said, though. Seems like such a good person.
Yeah.
Like, seems like a good person, seems like a good guy, really good at golf.
You know the comp? Andrew Luck.
Yeah. Like, won a lot more, but yeah.
Won a lot more, yes, but like, you, like, it would not shock me if Scottie Scheffler was just like 29 years old and was just like, you know what? I'm just going to turn this golf thing into a hobby.
Yeah. That I can see that. I mean, the comp is, I think, a strong one. Like, good guy.
Yeah.
Very white.
Fair. That's extremely fair. Extremely fair. But for any of those that do not follow golf, Scottie Scheffler just wrapped up his second Masters Championship at 27 years old. He's,
I
think, the third youngest to be under 27 or with the territory of Tiger Woods and Jack Nicholson. So that'll be good. So
We're not a golf podcast.
But yeah, exactly. There we go. That's why we're going into our strengths. Now, Brendan Murphy, you can give me some grief about that, botching that, as I talked about that and so tried to transition.
But hasn't hit a homer yet. He's got bigger things to do. He's got bigger fish to fry.
All right, so let's get into Weekend 9 recap across college baseball. There was a ton of stuff that happened across this weekend. Coming into the weekend, I guess it was a little bit of a lighter slate, but there were definitely some upsets. A couple in particular that we're not going to dive deep into is NC State winning the series against Clemson, which is going to create some movement, not only in the ACC, but also in the top 25. And then also there were a couple, South Carolina taking down Florida as Florida continues to reel in the wrong direction. And just a lot of really good baseball. West Virginia taking down UCF as UCF creeped into the rankings, and just a ton of series that we didn't exactly see coming. But, Dan, I got a couple quick hitters for you before we get going into these breakdowns of what we saw this past weekend. So the first, after this weekend, will we see a new number one at the top of the rankings?
Yeah, I think you're going to see most places jump Texas A&M above Arkansas and Clemson.
Okay. Fair. Both were upset this weekend in things we didn't expect to see happen. So that's big deal. So with that question, we've had this conversation a lot off air. A lot of people have asked, and this year, you know, last year we felt like going into at least the College World Series and the regionals, we had a pretty good sense of who the top teams in the country were, or at least who the most complete teams were in the country. Who, in your opinion, is the most incomplete team as we enter week 10 in college baseball?
Here's the thing about this is because no matter who I say, they're going to completely fold down the stretch.
Yeah, that's true.
So like I think Texas A&M, I really still like Arkansas, but Arkansas's offense just hasn't, I thought we were heading in the right direction. And we'll get into this in a little bit. Didn't look great this weekend. Tennessee's offensively is unbelievable. The pitching staff is getting better. They're trending in the right direction. I think you have an argument. The folks in Knoxville have an argument. I think Clemson has a little bit of an argument. Clemson, not so much. Like, it's complete, too. It's like, that's the thing, because you're not, like, the star power for Clemson, especially on the mound, it isn't there. There aren't a lot of names that everyone knows or recognizes, but we've said it a million times that Clemson has depth on the mound that gets the job done. They just know how to win games. Does that make them complete? Maybe. Their offense, again, like, outside of Cannarella. It's Texas. I think we're setting this up, so I'll say Texas A&M. I think Texas A&M right now has the argument to not only be number one, but also has the argument that they are the deepest and most complete team, not deepest, sorry, the most complete team in the country at the moment. I mean, when you look at what the guys at the front of the rotation have done, that offense is a nightmare to get through. The bullpen's done a good job. As we sit right now, Texas A&M. So sorry to everyone down at College Station, because things are probably going to take a terrible turn now that I've said that.
That's what I was thinking as we were prepping for this episode. I was like, we're really going to put a test to the backside ground balls curse and see how bad this thing is, because everybody we've anointed as the deepest and best team in the country has proceeded to go into the next week and lose. So another question that maybe, depending on your opinions, might surround Texas A&M and the Aggies as well. Transfer portal's become such a big part of college baseball. We've seen additions across the SEC, across top 10 programs, and that have made an impact. Transfer portal is going to open up on tax day, April 15th, as this comes out to our listeners. Who has been the most impactful transfer portal addition this season?
I think there's a lot of guys that have a case in this. If Florida wasn't 18-17, Colby Shelton had got off to a great start. Looked like it could be him. I think you could argue that Chase Burns is up there because of just kind of the singular performance of what he's done. The problem for me, when you look at it, is who's had the biggest impact. Chase Burns pitches one out of every four games a week. So, like, it's hard to, it's like voting for a pitcher for MVP. in Major League Baseball, where they're only making 30-some starts. So it's tough to say that they are the most impactful, most valuable. Same thing with my feeling here when I'm talking about Chase Burns, because he's been fantastic. And you could absolutely make a claim that he is the most impactful. But again, sticking with the theme of where we're heading with this, I mean, I don't know how anyone – you could argue there are a lot of guys. Me saying Braden Montgomery shouldn't cause too much argument from anyone.
No, it would not. It would not. And I think that shows a lot of the conversation that we're going to have today is going to be centered around the Aggies of Texas A&M. But I do want to do a quick question. I was perusing some schedules here, right? I would say at this point last year, we were pretty confident that at least one of the three of Wake Forest, LSU, and Florida, a little bit of question marks around LSU at this point last year, were going to be the last team standing. Let's just say hypothetically, we're looking at the field outside of the top teams that have kind of been mentioned a lot as national championship contenders. Is there any team that you have specifically circled that you think could be the year that they make a run and we get the surprise national champion that we weren't expecting on April 15th?
I've been talking for 30 seconds on mute. You got me. Letting it play out. This feels like a year, right? Like outside of kind of, I still think the three best teams to me right now are Arkansas, A&M, and Clemson in some order. I think, you know, like you said, and Tennessee, I think is absolutely in that conversation and you feel good about that. So even that's could only be half the field in Omaha if they take care of business. So there's going to be some unexpected things that go on, and a lot of teams can make a run. A lot of ACC teams that come to mind, you know, Florida State, Wake Forest, North Carolina could all absolutely make runs. Vanderbilt can still be there at the end of the year. It's weird, but for me, I think I'm just going to take this question a different way. I'm going to say ECU. And I know that probably feels weird, but this almost feels like one of those years where a small school can go on a run. We can see kind of one of these, you know, these teams standing at the end. Now, will it happen? I don't know. But I think it's not the hottest of takes. ECU is ranked ninth in the country right now. They just got done throwing two no-hitters in the same week. But they've taken care of business for the most part, right? Like they beat the teams they should. They had that huge series win against North Carolina, which North Carolina has the best record in the ACC right now. ECU has a series win against them under their belt. And again, like you said it, why does North Carolina have the best record in the ACC? It's because they don't lose to teams that they shouldn't. Okay, that's fine. They're still a really good team. They're still a team that we'll probably see in a super regional. I would expect to see Carolina in a super regional. ECU took a series from them. They have the ace, right? They have the guy that could be a first-round draft pick on the mound. That, to me, is so important down the stretch. Will they have the depth of arms, guys that can start, you know, games 3, 4, 5 in a week? Will they have the bullpen guys to get there? I don't know. But I like the offense. It's loaded with left-handed hitters, which I think can cause some of these teams problems. Unless you have a Hagan Smith or even like a Josh Hartle when you get into the playoffs. But I'm going to go with ECU just because it feels like a year where it's been really hard. We've gone back and forth on who are the best 10 teams in the country. We don't know. ECU has just continued to win baseball games. ECU continues to look good. They have an interesting end to the season. They're going to get a couple more opportunities against ACC teams. They still have Duke and NC State in the midweek slate coming up. So I'm excited to see those games, see how they handle business there. And unfortunately, since I just said ECU, they're probably going to slide here now the rest of the way.
What if I told you that my team that I want to choose for this conversation has losses on the year to Washington State, two losses to Kennesaw State, one loss to Missouri, one loss to Samford, and then I'm missing a loss somewhere as I was scanning through their record. Would you believe me that I thought that team could win a national championship?
Yeah, I think so. I think Go ahead. State your case.
The Kentucky Wildcats. The Kentucky Wildcats are sitting at 14-1 in the SEC. They handled their business against an Alabama team that we thought was reeling coming into the weekend that just handled their business against Arkansas. They took down Auburn, and man, Auburn has had a meat grinder of a start to the season. They took down Ole Miss when Ole Miss was riding hot and had some momentum. Georgia, same situation where they were riding hot and had some momentum there. They're currently sitting at 30-5. 30-5 as a team. Now, I will say the SEC slate gets a lot harder. They play host to Tennessee. They head to Columbia, South Carolina. They play host to Arkansas. They head to Florida, and they play host to Vanderbilt to end their season. So again, that sounds like more losses than 14-1 in the SEC, but you talk about a team that has absolutely handled their business up until this point, and we haven't exactly done a deep dive on their roster or what they have because they've kind of snuck up on everybody up to this point through the year. But it's a team that does it in different ways, right? Right now, currently, they're 77-97 on stolen bases, hitting .291 as a team, 47 home runs, more doubles. They have 75 doubles as a club. They're not a team that's going to go out there and just absolute bang. They're going to manufacture runs. They like to bunt, which give or take how your opinion is on whether that's valuable or not, but they seem to execute at a high level and they pitch into a 3.65 as a staff, striking out less batters per inning. But again, it's just one of those teams that's a club that does a lot of things the right way and they play the game the right way, depending on who you ask. And that's something that I think this is going to be the year where we could see the team that makes the least amount of mistakes become the team that is standing there at the end of the year, because it just feels like each and every team has had that roadblock and that hiccup. And again, remember, we're talking about teams outside of that Arkansas, you know, Texas A&M, even the teams that have struggled this year that we expected to be really good. I think a team that makes no mistakes is going to find themselves deep into the playoffs and deep into Omaha. Not necessarily saying winning a national championship, but I think if they can play clean baseball in June, they're going to be in a good spot.
What if I were to tell you I would set their it at 0.5 series wins the rest of the way, the over-under?
I would take the over.
You're looking at Florida and South Carolina is my assumption?
Just in general, like what we've seen in the SEC this year, like I don't even want to like sit there and say either or anybody or anything in general, just because of the fact that that's tough to kind of handicap that. There are going to be series losses in there, but there's also going to be unexpected series wins. Like, again, I mentioned Kentucky's five losses, and they've also played teams like Ole Miss, Georgia, Alabama, and Auburn, and they are combined 12-0 against those teams. But God forbid Missouri comes into your place on a Saturday and you don't trip up and fall. So I would say they at least get one the rest of the way, at least one. I would even probably alt line it to 1.5 and just assume that they're again, like we've talked about it with Florida. Could they get swept by Florida? 100%. Anybody could get swept by Florida with how much talent that team has. But God forbid Florida doesn't want to play that weekend. And next thing you know, Kentucky, they're not going to kick the ball around. They're not going to give away a series, and they're going to be in a good spot to win.
Well, I think the interesting thing too that you have to look at with, like, I would still say one for five here the rest of the way in series would be my guess here, and I would look at those two teams starting with South Carolina and Florida. But I think the interesting thing that we're going to see here is the thing that we've talked about a lot of times on here, especially we're dealing with college kids, and confidence is key. Like, if you get confident kids, like, there's nobody in that program in Lexington right now, any of those players 1 through 40 on that roster, who don't believe they're the best team in the country. They feel like they can beat anybody right now. They're, like you said, they're 30-5. They've been dominating SEC play, the hardest, you know, conference is what everybody says, the hardest conference in the country. They've rolled through it. They've ripped through it. They only have one loss on the year. You see teams like Arkansas losing series. They're the number one team in the nation. Kentucky hasn't lost a series. You know, you see LSU and Florida stumble. You see Vanderbilt stumble. It's like you can't convince me that if you walked in that locker room and you said, and you took a poll in there and said, you guys best team in the country? Every single one of them would say yes. Everything single one of them are riding high. So I think that also can help them a little bit because they are so – it's almost one of those things where people say, you know, they're too young to understand. They're too young and stupid because they just like – you. I bet you can't tell them the flaws that they have. I bet you can't tell them that they haven't played their hardest part of their schedule yet. They know that these are going to be big series, but to these guys, they've all probably been big series. You know, going to Auburn and sweeping – they don't care that Auburn's now 3-12. That was a big deal to them, right? Going to Ole Miss and sweeping. They don't care that Ole Miss is, I think there were 6-8 in conference now or something like that. They don't care that Ole Miss, you know, is below 500. They went out there and they, you know, they kicked their butts. And for them, I think that will help them a lot. And we see it all the time. When you get college kids that are just confident, a little bit cocky, and just kind of believe that, hey, we're really good. We think we are. We know we are. We believe we are. They go play loose. They go play relaxed. They could win this. I also think just because of what we've seen a little bit, I think being at home against, you know, for three of those series, you know, they're only two – the road series there are South Carolina and Florida. So you avoid having to go to Rocky Top. You avoid having to go to Bone Walker. You avoid having to go to Vanderbilt. That at least helps them a little bit. You get all three of those teams coming to your place where you could sucker punch these teams. Because the thing, though, is at this point at 14-1 in conference, there's a target on their back. No one's
–
none of these – like Tennessee this weekend is not going to head to Kentucky thinking, oh, it's Kentucky. Like that's a rivalry. That's – you know, it's a border war. That's a – those are two teams that typically don't like each other. Tennessee knows they're 14-1. Tennessee believes they're really good too. That's going to be an interesting series, and it'll be a good test.
Yeah, and we can dive into Kentucky's roster and what they've been able to do this year, obviously, because that's going to be one of the top series heading into this weekend, because it could probably potentially be two top five programs in the country. I mean, depending on how the shakeup is and depending on what publication you follow, there's definitely going to be an argument to be made for Kentucky to be top five in the country. Let's head down to College Station to talk about this series as Texas A&M, who's currently sitting at 32-4 with a 24-1 record at home, absolutely handled the Commodores of Vanderbilt. They won 15-0 in a Mercy Rule 7-inning convincing fashion. Then they knocked Carter Holton out on Saturday early to the tune of a 9-0 victory. Obviously, extreme length out of their starting pitching. Ryan Prager went 7 shutout innings, complete game on Friday, saved the bullpen. Tanner Jones went 7 1/3 shutout innings, saved the bullpen again. And then in 12-6 on Sunday, won convincing fashion to sweep the series. When we talk about Texas A&M, we're going to talk about the club specifically. But I'm starting to really feel like this is the best home environment when they're playing good baseball in the country and they make it a nightmare on opposing pitchers. And there's nowhere you would want to be as a guy struggling to find the strike zone than College Station in June in a regional is all I could think watching the games this weekend.
Just that is so bad. The Vanderbilt's pitching. I mean, it, like you said, going into that place and having to pitch in high, like just high leverage situations, conference series, regional, super, as you get further into the season, it's really tough. Add in the fact the guys that you have to get through, like that walk up to the plate in A&M's lineup that you then have to navigate through. Makes it even a steeper challenge. And like you said, as we get deeper into this, as we get into June, that atmosphere is just going to continue to just be louder, be more intense, be more, be tougher to navigate and perform in. And it's so impressive to me, this lineup. Like, that's why when you say most complete to me, like just looking at this lineup, this is the type of college offense that we've gotten accustomed to over the last couple of years, winning a national championship, right? You look at the guys that were in that LSU lineup that were anchored by Cruz and White, and you look at, you know, even the teams that that they, you know, even the Florida team that they had, they played to win the national championship that had Cags and Wyatt Langford. This lineup has that type of star power. This lineup is like, just before you even get to Jackson Appel, it's like just brutal. The top three is, in my opinion, probably the best top three in the country right now, as far as just how dynamic those guys are at controlling the strike zone, putting the barrel to the ball and doing complete and total damage, gaps, extra base hits, hitting the ball over the yard. And if you go in there, and like that's what makes it even tougher, is because of the fact that all three of those guys and really everyone in this A&M lineup will take a walk. I think the most impressive thing to me was like Vanderbilt came out and tried to attack, right? Bryce Cunningham, they walked two guys on Friday night, two guys on Friday night. Saturday was a completely different story. They were a little bit uncompetitive in the zone, Vanderbilt on Saturday. But Friday, they only walked two guys. It's just everybody in the lineup goes for multi-hit, has a multi-hit game, and that's how you get 15 hung on you, because if you are going to be competitive in the zone, your stuff better be, you know, your best stuff that night, or else they're just going to do damage. They're going to hit balls over the yard. They're going to hit balls in the gap. They're going to continue to just, you know, they do kind of everything. And then, you know, we'll get into this in a second, but then you got, like, and then it's hard to score off of them. So, like, you constantly have to feel like you're chasing against Texas A&M, because it's like you feel like every single – it probably feels like every inning one of those three guys is coming to the plate. And you're like, again? I thought we just got through this part of the order. And they're back up. And then there's a quick inning by, you know, by Prager or any of these, you know, other arms that have thrown the ball so well for A&M. And it's just – it's miserable. Especially, like you said, you know, going to – College Station right now is not easy.
No, my palms get sweaty when they start chanting ball four. I'm not going to lie. But like, if I like, you could see, I mean, you talked about them struggling to find the strike zone on Saturday. Like it impacted Holton. Like it did. And that's a dude who's pitched in very, very important games in his college career that he was very obviously impacted by the crowd, and they love that, and obviously that just gets the crowd more engaged and more into it. But I mean, when you talk about this Texas A&M team, and I want to talk about the pitching as much as anybody, right? Because that's been the highlight. This is a team that last year in Coach Schlossnagel's second season, that's where their struggle was, right? They struggled a little bit in with the pitching, and it's taken a huge step forward. But you can't get far into talking about this team without talking about the three-headed monster of Braden Montgomery, Jace LaViolette, and Gavin Grohevic. That trio has 19 home runs for Montgomery, LaViolette has 16, and Grohevic has 13. Like that's far and away like leading the club, right? When we look at, and we'll look at Tennessee's lineup in a minute, when you look at their lineup, it's more spread out and it's more 1 through 9. This is a three-headed monster that has to put so much fear in pitchers. And I mean, Friday was a great example of Braden Montgomery had two home runs. LaViolette had two home runs. The rest of the lineup did what they needed to do. Next thing you know, 15 runs are up on the board. LaViolette had two home runs early in the game to kind of put the game away. Montgomery had a couple later in the game. It's just one of those things where it's like you cannot compete with guys that are that good, like just dynamic talents. And it's really impressive because what they've been able to do as an offense has been centered around what those three are able to do. And the rest of the pieces now, instead of being, and I mean, imagine this team without Braden Montgomery and LaViolette, not saying he struggled. It was more of just like homer or bust kind of stretch for a little bit there as his average dipped below 300 for a really dynamic hitter. But if they didn't have the addition of Braden Montgomery this year, I mean, you talked about it in the most important transfer edition. I mean, they would be a completely, completely different lineup because they'd be relying on true freshman Gavin Grohevic, who has been great. That's awesome, but still a true freshman. And then LaViolette, who's had the highs and lows of the season, but seemed to get on a heater this past weekend. So Braden Montgomery has been absolutely huge for this offense that has followed suit to the tune of a 307 as a club. With 73 home runs, with the majority of them coming from those three.
And just real quick before we can start, you know, if you want to start talking about their pitching just on those threes, like they've also combined for 90 walks.
Yeah.
89 walks. Like it's like, and that's my point. It's like, so again, it's like, okay, you want to be careful with those three. They're going to take their walk. They're not necessarily going to like, you know, Montgomery and LaViolette are basically, you know, 1-to-1 strikeout to walk. Grahovic, who's a true freshman, you expect it. It's about 2-1 strikeout to walk. That's fine, but he's still taking his 21 walks. The other two are in the mid-30s. Like, it's just like it's insane. Like, that's what makes it so tough when not only when these guys can – when you can impact the baseball the way they do, hit for the power. I mean, they – and then take the walk. Be patient. Be unselfish and not go up there and, like, I'm going to be the guy to do it. No, I'll take the walk, and you got to go through the next guy. And then to have after that – like, you get through those three, and then you have Jackson Appel hitting in the four hole, who's hitting 358 himself. Like, so it's just like, just you can just go through that entire lineup. And that, again, when we start to talk about who are these teams at the top, that's what Arkansas is missing.
Yeah, oh, 100%. And that's why you start to build the perception that Texas A&M can and will be a contender late in Omaha, especially with the coach that they have there, who's been there on basically a biannual basis when he was at TCU. And it feels like he's always taken really good teams deep into Omaha. Like, that was just kind of common for Coach Schlossnagel and what he's done. So speaking of Coach Schlossnagel, maybe the most important offseason addition was the addition of pitching coach Matt Schweiner. Combined as a staff, we mentioned this, they're pitching to a 3.14. They have 414 strikeouts, 109 walks in 315 innings. It's led by Ryan Prager, who missed all of last year due to an injury. He entered the Florida start rolling. He had zero earned runs on the year, was punching out way more than a batter per inning. There was a hiccup there, right? Six earned runs against a really good Florida team. Wind was blown out. He's not a guy that overpowers hitters. He's been good ever since. Solid start against Mississippi State. Okay start against Auburn. Okay start against South Carolina. Well, he looked like the Prager that was at the beginning of the season through the first four starts that he had. He had 10 strikeouts against Vanderbilt in seven innings pitched with zero walk. I mean, this is a guy who's walked five batters on the year. And just collectively as a pitching staff outside of Prager, what they've been able to do this season has just been unreal. I mean, the production that they're getting on the mound and how, knowing the offense that they have, they're able to keep them in every game. And if they can keep teams off the board the way they kept Vanderbilt off the board this year, it's like the sky's the limit for this club. I mean, this is a team that pitched to a 5-6-7 last year and walked about a half or 320 batters in 566 innings. So, like, a ton of batters. And just to see the complete 360 from this club with a lot of the same names is just a credit to what Weiner's been able to do in his first season in college baseball this year.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And that's, again, this is kind of what you build the confidence from as you watch. You know, we talked about the frontline guys. You talk about Tanner Jones, you talk about Prager. And Prager, I mean, like you said it, you mentioned it, but 73 strikeouts to five walks in 50 innings is, like, that's unbelievable. Like, that's a guy, like, we should be talking a lot more about him and what he's been able to do. He's pitching. He has a .76 whip. I mean, his numbers are absolutely insane. And as a whole, at the pitching staff, like, when you get past those guys, Lampkin kind of had a dud today. And luckily, when you get a guy who can't go deep in game three, goes an inning and two thirds, gives up four runs, you got to turn to the bullpen. Well, the first two guys save the bullpen. Prager goes seven. We mercy rule. We don't have to play anymore. So he goes complete game. Next game, we use our best guy to close it out in a 9-0 game, an inning and two thirds, Evan Ashenbeck. And then we'll just bring him right back to save game three. And in between, the bridge guy in between is going to be Chris Cortez, and he's going to give us four. He's pitching to a 2-3-2. He's got 47 strikeouts in 31 innings. So when you look at it, it's like they have the starting pitching. They have the two really good relievers that they rely on a lot. Brad Rudis is another guy that, you know, I think 12 appearances this year, he's got a sub-1 ERA. They have the pieces, right? Like, we talked about Clemson's depth in the bullpen. A&M can match it. They've had guys that they've been very successful with. Like you said, the credit to the coaching staff and to the players for buying in and making the adjustments to come back and be this much better year over year is really impressive.
Yeah, and they deserve all the credit in that club. And Cortez is a guy that, from a bullpen standpoint, I mean, you're talking about 97 and 99 with bowling ball level sink, who's going to be a guy that can dominate any lineup across the country. So this team, what they've been able to do, super impressive. They're probably most likely going to be the number one team in the country entering next weekend. In the SEC, you have no easy. There's no walks in the park. There's no easy series. So you know they're going to have the opportunity to drop some games. They're probably going to have a hiccup or two. They're going to head to Alabama, who's obviously coming off a great weekend as they took the series from Arkansas, giving Arkansas their first series loss on the year. Again, Arkansas, we've talked about this ad nauseum, it feels like. Arkansas's biggest Achilles heel of this team is going to be the offense. And it came and it bit them in the butt. They only scored 8 runs across the series. And that is fine when Hagan Smith pitches, right? When Hagan Smith goes out there and this is a guy that's going to dominate any lineup in the country, by all means, you can score 8 runs across the series. But when 5 of those runs came in the first 3 innings of a Hagan Smith start off of a really good starter in Ben Hess, and then you completely go down in shutdown mode, it raises a lot of question marks about what this team's ceiling can be. Their pitching is going to keep them in every game, series, anything across the board. But you still have to put runs on the board to win, and you're also going to face high-level pitching at some point. So really, alarm bells are going off right now, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, it's tough to swallow when your starting pitchers give you 17 innings across a series and only give up 3 runs, you expect to win the series, right? Like, we gave up 3 earned runs. As our 3 starters gave up a combined 3 earned runs, we should at least be 2-1, right? And now the bullpen struggled a little bit, but they only gave up 7 earned in 10 innings. You know, we've seen a lot worse. You see a lot worse all the time out of bullpens in college baseball. You see bullpens give up 7 earned in 1 game a lot in college baseball. So yeah, they had, you know, they pitched 10 innings and they gave up 7 runs. Okay, that happens. You should still have won this series. We knew this was going to happen, though. I think we've kind of hinted at this was the concern, you know. And like I said, I was hoping that Arkansas's offense was heading in the right direction. They'd flash some signs. Peyton Stovall come back and been phenomenal. You were hoping that they were going to turn the corner. This is a little bit concerning. I still think – I just think this was the hiccup that should have happened earlier in the year. And they finally got bit on the road against an Alabama team who really, really, really needed this series. They looked like they were kind of trending in the wrong direction a little bit. So this was kind of Alabama. You went in and you had an Alabama team with their backs against the wall. And credit to Alabama for doing a good job and winning the series and keeping Arkansas's offense at bay. I don't know how alarmed I am, though, just from the standpoint of that pitching staff giving up 3 runs across 17 innings. They're going to win the rest. If they do that the rest of the season, they're going to win those series because Arkansas has found a way to score the runs necessary to win their series all year up until this point. If you want to start getting into postseason play, if we were previewing regionals and supers and the World Series, I would say, look, this is why I have some concern about Arkansas. They have a handful of series left now to get it right. Hopefully we start to see some of the signs we were seeing from the offense leading up to this point the last few weeks moving forward here. And then, you know, I'm not ready yet to kind of ring the alarm on my end. But if we continue to see this, look, if you're getting – again, you can't score 8 runs. You can't do it. Like, you got to be better than that. In this era of college baseball, the ball, the way it flies, the way we teach hitting, we need more than 8 runs for me to be confident that you're going to be standing at the end.
Do they have the guys to do it?
I don't know. That's been the question the whole time, right? Like, you feel like maybe, but at what point here, 40 games in, are we like, well, maybe not?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have talent. That's Arkansas, right? They've never been short on talent. We see it on the mound. They have talent. Guys like Kendall Diggs, Peyton Stovall, Sprague Lott, I mean, Wahiwa Aloy, like McLaughlin, like there's guys that can play. It's just, so maybe it is. Yeah, I think they were putting a lot of their chips in the Aloy basket. And while he's talented and dynamic, he's still young. 9 home runs on the year. Strikeouts are a little bit of a problem. doesn't walk a ton. Like, those ratios aren't great, but I mean, it was expected. He was coming from the WAC where he hit 370, and 370 in the WAC doesn't exactly translate to 370 in the SEC. His power numbers have gone up, which is good. So, but I think he was expecting him to be like SEC first team all conference guy is probably a next year thing and probably a realistic next year thing. There's no doubt about that. It's just outside of that, it's underwhelming. I mean, 276 as a club, 52 home runs on the year. You don't really run. You don't really leave the yard as much as these other top teams that we're talking about. And again, Alabama was in wounded animal mode. So it's credit to them for showing up, especially after having their ace knocked around for five earned in five innings. And when you lose those games, when you're talking about having a first round arm on the mound, it's tough to recover from. And especially when you don't exactly come out and beat the starting pitchers up ever in another start. So showed battle tested, really impressed with what Coach Vaughn has been able to do with that club in his first year. But, I mean, you tell me, you think this is Arkansas lost this series more than Alabama won this series, right?
Yeah. I mean, we might be not giving Alabama's pitching staff the credit they deserve.
Yeah,
here.
They're.
I mean, they did a great job.
Did really good on Saturday, and then obviously on Sunday as well. Zane Adams came out and was really good.
Yes, but I kind of feel the same way you do. Like, it's like just because of kind of the expectations of Arkansas, and what their pitching staff set up for them. Like, again, you kind of bear the responsibility of being, you know, the presumed best team in the country. And that comes with expectations. And the expectations are when you get the pitching that Arkansas gets weekend in and weekend out, the offense has to produce. And you would think, like you said, they did put a lot of eggs in the Aloy basket. And they put a lot of eggs in Jared Sprague Lott. You know, it's another transfer that they expected a lot from. And he's answered the bell a little bit. But, like, we just need more. Like you said, what is this offensive identity? What do they do? They don't really bang it around the yard. They don't really run. They don't really walk. They don't really put
pressure
on you.
They don't really hit for high average.
That's what I'm saying. They don't really they swing and miss. Like, so it's like they just kind of feel like
bunt.
A blah offense. Right. Like, what do they do? I don't know what Arkansas's offensive identity is. And so then you ask the question, well, do they have the guys? I don't know. I don't know if they do. You know the names because they play at Arkansas. You know where they come from. You know the track record of some of these guys. I don't know if they have enough to get it done. Again, it can continue to get better because of the talent that you know they have. They are talented. Mm-hmm. Those kids are talented. But we're 35 games in. So is this just kind of who they are? Are they going to have to just pitch it to get there? I don't know. They could probably do it. They're going to get a really good draw because they're going to be one of the top three seeds most likely if they finish the year the way they've played up to this point. They'll be a top three seed. They'll get a favorable draw. So that could help them because they could use the pitching to get there. We'll see.
Yeah, and I guess all things considered, if they get – assuming they get to Omaha, you get in the spacious confines – you're going to want to be pitching anyway, and we've seen too many teams that rely a lot on offense, and specifically offense at some smaller parks when you get into the bowels of Omaha and try to leave the yard there. It just doesn't happen, and offenses kind of go there to die. So I guess there's this silver lining there, and I mean, the talent is there. There's no doubt about that, but I'll be interested to see. And again, maybe – I came out a little hot and heavy, and then I'm sitting there going, they're 30-5. They're 12-3 in the SEC. They've won every series that they're supposed to win. They're allowed to have hiccups. They're allowed to have roadblocks. When we were talking about LSU at this point last year, it was a lot of question marks about everybody except for Paul Skeens, and they went on to win the national championship. So I'm not completely writing off this Arkansas club, but I do think that there's some truth to the fact that they just offensively, they don't look good. They don't look good to the eye test. They don't look good to the stat nerds. They don't look good to anybody. Like, it's just, it's not what you envision of like a truly dynamic, complete team, especially when comparing them to other teams across the SEC. Like one in particular, Tennessee Volunteers. Tennessee Volunteers, they've come into this year. They've had a lot of turnover. They lose Chase Burns and everybody thinks, whoa, what's that all about? Why would he leave? He felt like a good situation. He felt like he was going to be the guy as Dolander went off to the MLB draft. And he just gets on the first flight out of town. He was touring some schools and wanted to get out of there. Offense had some turnover as well, with a lot of guys heading to the next level. It was a team last year that obviously we had mentioned several times came out the gate slow. We compare a lot of teams this year to them. We're questioning whether their opponent, LSU, was going to be like that, where we're still going to see this team in Omaha. Obviously, they've trended in a different direction. Tennessee hasn't exactly played the toughest FCC schedule. They've had some tough series to play. They have some impressive wins throughout the year, but it hasn't been the gauntlet that some of these other teams have faced. It's only going to get harder from here. They go to Kentucky, face Missouri, who gave them problems last year, Florida, Vanderbilt, South Carolina to end out their season, but this is a team that, as it stands right now, is sitting at 30-6, 10-5 in conference play. They're 25-2 at home on a 6-game winning streak, and they just got Billy Amick back, who's been one of their most productive players, and they could still use for a little bit of addition from guys that are still on the injured reserve. But just an impressive weekend from them as they swept LSU again. What is LSU? I don't know. I can't, at this point, I can't tell you. Just not really a very good team, I guess, is what I would say. But still, sweeping the reigning national champions on your home turf, that's impressive nonetheless.
I'm so tired of talking about LSU. They're 20.
So
much. What is LSU? They're 22.
Well, you know when we're not going to have to talk about them.
12 in conference. So,
you know when we're not going to have to talk about them, Dan?
No, sorry.
In June. We're not going to have to talk about them. So.
Well, yeah. Look, Tennessee's offense. You want to know how you said it? Like, there was offensive turnover, and Chase Burns was transferring, and you know, a year after they went to Omaha and they went on that run. They had been really. We've mentioned this before. You know, they've been one of the most talked about teams for the last 2 years, and then a lot of those guys left. It felt like a transition year a little bit, and then. They slug 657. I don't know what else to really say about them. They slug 657 as a team. And like they have, what, five regulars and with double-digit home runs? Five or six guys with double-digit home runs?
Five, yes.
They're ridiculous. I mean, and Blake Burke is unbelievable. Billy Amick, like just all of them. We talked about how tough it was to face the guys in A&M's lineup and get through it. And I know Tennessee's yards play small, but like you look at Tennessee's lineup and it's like, well, how do you navigate through this one? And that's what they do. They consistently put pressure on you. They've allowed their pitching staff to kind of figure things out a little bit. Drew Beam got off to a slow start. AJ Russell's been out. Because the offense is so good, they didn't miss a beat. They allowed the pitching staff to kind of round into form. And this is just kind of what you saw last year. We got to the midway point. The offense wasn't nearly as successful last year at this point, but the pitching staff was kind of like they hadn't figured it out. We moved Chase Burns to the bullpen. We shuffled the rotation around. They took off, and next thing you know, they were playing late in June. It kind of feels this way with the pitching staff again for Tennessee, where it's like they have the injury to Russell. What's Drew Beam going to be? We need to shuffle things around. We need to figure out who slots into what role. And credit to Tony Vitello, because it seems like at this time every year, Tennessee just starts to take off, right? Like pitching and offense come together. They start playing their best ball, which again, we say it all the time on here. The coach cliche of this is, you know, we wouldn't be playing our best ball in April, May, and June. Tennessee's got that down. That's what it feels like every year they're doing. And it's this year it's led, you know, kind of reminds me of 2 years ago a little bit, where it was led by that offense that just constantly hit balls out of the yard. It was an electric factory. Rocky Top's a really fun place to play, it looks like, if you're wearing the right colors. And so it kind of feels similar to last year to me in how good they are offensively. And now the pitching staff is starting to figure things out.
Yeah. I'm doing a little bit of math over here. So when you look at 2022 Tennessee Volunteers, you mentioned them a little bit on the backs of offense, 308 as a team, 158 home runs. It's 2 years ago. This is not that long ago. This is not 2017 when the environment was dead, right? Always factor in late in the season, some numbers change, you face better pitchers, you stop having midweek games. All of that stuff has to be factored in here. So take this with a grain of salt. 330 as a club right now, 95 home runs, on pace in the 56-game season. Now, again, they played 66 games in 2022. They are on pace to hit 204 home runs as a team in 56 games.
Yeah.
This is what?
I mean, it's insane. It's insane. And then just in time, here comes the pitching staff starting to, you know, we're starting to slot guys into roles they seem comfortable in. They're starting to figure out who they are. And that's what makes them so dangerous.
Wow. 204 as a club.
You're fired up. Tennessee Trent's coming out. You haven't been paying attention.
If they played 66 games this year, they'd hit 241 home runs. Wow. No, right? I just like putting it into perspective. Wait, of on. Like full season. What?
Oh, because that's another 30 games. Yeah, they'd hit. Yeah.
So yeah. They'd double.
Sorry, I was checking your math. Because that number, it really doesn't feel real.
It doesn't feel real. I have it on a – it. So 40 games would remain. Oh, maybe I did punch it in wrong. They played 36 games. Sorry. We just made a big deal about this.
So they have 30 games left. But I mean,
So it's going to be a little bit closer. So I was 10
Let's
off.
Say we're halfway. They're going to hit 200 home runs.
So in 56 games, they'll hit 147. So not as crazy as it seemed. And then at 66, they will – okay, good. Well,
but
good job.
180, if they play 60-some games, it's 180 home runs.
174 home runs if they play 66 games. So they would break that 2022 team, which was arguably the best team offensively since the BB Corps era, one of them at least, and they are going to outpace them, slugging 50 points higher than that club did and on getting on base at about 15 points higher. So on pace to shatter already impressive stats. And again, Cannon Peebles is a guy that they transferred in from NC State, who was a guy who they thought was going to be really good, and he hasn't been great, but everybody else has been really. I mean, Billy Amick obviously came over from Tennessee, has just lit the world on fire. He had those two home runs coming off an injury, missing a couple of weeks, and he's hitting 370. And like, again, Blake Burke's hitting 414 with 12 bombs. Christian Moore's hitting like the sneakiest 352 with 15 bombs in the country. Sneakiest. Like, nobody talks about him, it feels like.
You know what's funny?
What?
Clemson could really use Billy Amick.
Yeah, well, there's a reason why people leave.
About, like, how much more dynamic that offense would be with him in the middle of it.
In college baseball, in college athletics today, there's reasons why people leave. That is not because of loyalty to your programs and the friends that and the relationships you've built in your 2 years on campus, Dan. And I'm not confirming that Billy Amick has a check in his bank account right now from the Volunteer Collective, but I'm pretty much assuming that NIL played a role in Billy Amick's transfer to Tennessee.
Yeah, there's an NIL joke to be made there.
Sure. Yes. So let's head over to the pitching side of things. You mentioned it a little bit while I was typing away, trying to figure out my miscalculations for what the offense was going to do as they were putting up literally MVP baseball 2005 numbers in terms of what I was calculating. Create your own field, 250 all the way around, high fence type style. There, if you know, you know. That's all I got to say about that. Pitching is definitely still a question mark. Losing AJ Russell, who was good in his starts, but not dominant, but ton of swing and miss. Not a ton of walks, ton of swing and miss. Kind of looked like if, like, just give him more time and he would probably turn into the ace that they expected him to be. They've had some shuffling around of their rotation. Drew Beam's been pitching on Saturdays all year. AJ Causey is a guy who moved into the rotation. They decided them to have him now piggyback starter on Friday, which really worked out. Again, they won on Friday night in convincing fashion, which is really impressive. So the pitching's still taking shape. Nothing you'll ever question about Tennessee. There's certain guys in the MLB that throw 100 plus. A lot of them have come from Tennessee. Chase Burns, yes, he threw 100 before getting to college, but he also played at Tennessee. It's a theme there. Kirby Connell's a guy in the bullpen who looks like another elite arm. 97 to 100. He's only had 6 walks in 18 innings pitched. If you can throw 97 to 100 in the strike zone in college baseball, that's a lot of swing and miss right there. And they have some dudes that they can rely on. But there's definitely still the question mark there that has to be answered and really just figured out and refined. But I think they're ultimately probably going to be okay.
Yeah, I think, like, again, that's what we talk about. And credit to Tony Vitello, because he did the same thing last year where it's like, he truly kind of understands that when things start in February, I'm sure he would love to be able to pencil his starting rotation in and just ride that the rest of the way, but he hasn't been able to do that. But the credit to him goes when every time around this year, they start to take shape. And kind of like Chase Burns coming out of the bullpen last year, to me, what Xander Seacrest has been able to do for them, kind of stabilizing things at the end of the weekend, he's made 8 starts and only thrown 26 and two-thirds, so it's not like he's pitching deep into games all the time. But just, again, when you have an offense like this, it's like, just get us a lead. We'll patch it together the rest of the way. Just keep us in the game early. You know, throw up a couple zeros. This offense is going to score. No one's gonna shut us out. Keep us in it, and we'll piece it together. And when you get to Sundays, that's what he's been able to do. And like you said, the move to take AJ Cossey and have him piggyback and be kind of the bulk innings in the middle makes a lot of sense. Go throw a reliever that's going to throw up a couple, you know, 2 innings, max effort, throw up a couple of zeros. We'll have a 4-0 lead. Then bring him in and let him throw the middle innings there, get you to the back end of your bullpen, coming in with a lead. Like, it's just like, it makes sense. And if this is how they have to work it, I like it. I like when teams get creative, because it doesn't always have to be the traditional 1-2-3. You're looking for 18 to 21 from those starters. It's a lot to ask in an era where guys are operating at their maximum capacity for longer, you know, for long periods of time. So I'm talking about starters, right? When we're asking guys to be max effort for 5-6 innings, it's tough. It's tough at the college level. We don't always have the arms to do it. That doesn't mean you don't have enough good arms, especially when you're pitching on a team that has an offense that Tennessee does. You can win games. You can win conferences. You can win championships doing it. I believe that. You got to have a lot of them, and you got to trust it, and everybody's got to be bought in. But how they're kind of working things, how Vitello kind of manages it, he's obviously a great recruiter, and he builds these teams with these great offenses. But what's really impressed me the last 2 years is the strings he's pulled mid-season that has kind of sparked some things. I was critical last year when he benched the entire offense for a midweek. Like, I was a little critical of that, because to me, that's like it was a weird move after the Missouri series. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but they sparked it, moving Chase Burns to the bullpen, shuffling the rotation last year, shuffling the rotation this year. You lost A.J. Russell, and like you said, he had only thrown 12 and a third. No, his numbers weren't outrageous. The swing and miss, the stuff looked amazing. I think he would have settled in, and he would have been your legit Friday guy. They lose him. A lot of teams, that kind of derails the season. They wouldn't be sitting here in the position that Tennessee is, talking about what feels like a slam dunk top 5 team.
Oh, definitely a slam dunk top 5 team. And I think, I guess if there is anything that worries me, it seems to be a lot on the backs of a select few guys. Sneed's giving you 40 innings out of the pen. Beam's obviously starting. Causey's been between. Numbers look really good. I think the 4.75 ERA is just a blip. But then a lot, 3.9, 6.2, 11.2, 3.11, 32.1.
Paper mache, baby. Piece it together. Like, if that's what you have to do, go do it. You're doing it to the tune of a 3.75.
No, and that's very impressive. It's just you're one hiccup, one slump away from losing guys that have 30-plus innings. And who do you go to? Like, with Russell still being out and there still being no clarity on the situation, hopefully it irons itself out, because this offense is going to be fun to watch, and I want this offense selfishly to play as long as possible, because getting to see these 5 guys at the top of their lineup, and Dean Curley's probably going to cross the double-digit home run to make it 6 here in the next couple days. I think everybody deserves to watch this offense play for a long time.
Oh, no doubt. You want to talk about LSU now? What else we got to do? You want to talk about LSU for a while here?
No, I mean, just is there a national championship curse? But like,
I guess in the SEC,
I guess. Yeah, I got nothing to say. Like I said, we're not going to talk about the Tigers in June. What?
No, let me ask you a question. Who's LSU's? I'm trying to figure out what number I want you to give me, because three, you could make an argument. That's pretty easy. Who's LSU's five best players this year? Tommy White. Absolutely.
Luke Coleman.
Right.
Luke Coleman. Does it have to be offensively?
No,
or both?
Luke Coleman and Tommy White are the two that, like, for sure. But, like, then, like, pitch me on any
Travinsky's of these other guys. Travinsky's been great. Like, I like what he's done. Catcher giving you power. He's had a ton of big hits.
Yeah.
Jared Jones, again, same situation. A lot of strikeouts, but he has a ton of value. Yeah. So I'd say those three are definite. I mean, but you've gotten a lot of underperformance with Holman as well, and then Gage Jump heading in the wrong direction has crushed them.
That's what
when it was top two, and again, maybe that was us expecting too much from Jump, but he came out the gates and he was pitching well and everybody was kind of feeling it, and now he's not pitching good at all. So yeah, it's not, I mean, Malam's hitting 313, no homers, like, he is kind of what he is, slugging under 400. Just like Braswell has been good. Actually, Braswell, you could probably, he's under 450. I got a little bit of overlap there looking at Travinsky's power numbers with Braswell. It's like, oh, that's good. And then, no. So,
but Braswell's been better than he was at South Carolina offensively.
Yeah, but they needed him to be.
But that was kind of a stretch. I felt like we knew, like, we watched him play in the SEC last year and saw kind of what he was. I think, like, the fact that he's hitting 291 and at least produce a little bit, he's come up big in a couple spots early in the year. Yeah, it's just tough. It's a tough. And again, like, we're being critical of a team that just won a national championship that recruits at the highest level, that next year will be fine.
But I think the problem that they recruit at the highest level. Like, that's the problem I have, is the fact that
think it's necessary to work some of these guys in the year after winning a national championship, like the law. Now, I think the thing that's so disappointing for you and I is the fact that they do recruit at the highest level, and it's so bad. It's 22-15 and 3-12 in the SEC. That's what's frustrating. It's the same thing with Florida. Like, if Florida's 18-17 and you also recruit at the highest level, you're in the most fertile baseball state in the country, it's kind of inexcusable.
But to even push back on that, like, yes, I agree with what you're saying, but where they have struggled is Aiden Moffitt was there last year. Griffin Herring was there last year. Gage Jump was hurt last year. Gavin Guidry, Javon Coleman, Nate Alkenhausen, Thatcher Hurd, Christian Little, Cam Johnson. Like Cam Johnson wasn't, he's a freshman, but like a lot of these guys were there last year. And if you could make an argument, that this was a problem last year on the pitching side of things. Yep. They just masked it. They had Paul Skeens, who was generational, and Ty Floyd figured it out on the back end, and Thatcher Hurd started to pitch well, and they pieced it together with a dynamic, unbelievable, historically good lineup. And that was on the backs of transfer portal. And again, I'm as big of a fan of Jay Johnson's as anybody in the country, especially with what he did at Arizona. He's always had good offenses as a guy who loves guys that have good offenses. He's got the cool little pen in the back of the hat that kind of looks neat for anybody looking at the YouTube now. Yeah, I mean, it should bother a lot of people. What's the pen doing back there? You're supposed to be writing with it. But this is now 2 out of 3 years where LSU has, again, if they had not won the national championship last year, he's had an underwhelming start to his tenure. Like, there's no other way to say it other than the fact that, like, this year's been brutally bad. That's when a national championship generational talents, and then the year before was, it's his transition year, which is fine. But in the transfer portal era, you're going out there, you're grabbing Tommy White's of the world, you're bringing in Paul Skeens of the world, you're bringing in Thatcher Hurd, you're bringing in all these big names, Luke Coleman, like, it's kind of inexcusable to be LSU and have a team this bad.
I understand that. That's a big asterisk you're putting on it, though. He's been a disappointment if he hadn't won a national championship. He did win the national championship. They won the national championship. I understand the generational talent, but going into the postseason last year, I don't know why I'm defending them, but going into the postseason last year, they were not the number one team in the country. They were not everyone's – it's not like they were the heavy favorites. They were one of the teams that could have won it, but Wake Forest was the one seed. They weren't the heavy favorite, and they ended up getting hot at the right time. I do agree with your point, though, where you recruit – with the transfer portal, with the money that you have from boosters, it feels inexcusable to have a year as poor as this. And I know they've had a tough SEC schedule, but come on. Like 3-12. And like, honestly, two of the series, the way you look at it, like you lost the Florida series at home. Mississippi State's been playing a lot better this year, but you should still be better than Mississippi State. Those two series, that's really tough. We'd feel a little bit better about them and be a little more understandable if they had won those series. They sweep one of those series, then you're sitting there going, okay, it's a down year. They're not playing great. They've played a really tough SEC schedule. I hear you. To be LSU, to recruit at that level, to have the talent that you have, to have the coaching staff that you have.
Yes.
It's tough.
And to not lose
Wes Johnson. It's not like they replaced Wes Johnson with a young guy who had never been in the position before or been at the highest stage. I mean,
they replaced him with Nate Yeske.
You get one of the best pitching coaches of the last, 15 years in college baseball.
Yeah. No, and again, I'm not – it's just – it's one of those things where it's like I know you said – you can't take the national championship out of it. But it's like you had two generational talents in college baseball. And it's like that's the difference sometimes. It's like,
yeah, but I mean, you could argue Caglione and Langford were generational.
Yeah. But that was I don't know. I just think
Rhett Lauder and Nick Kurtz were on the Wake Forest team that they beat.
And Brock Wilkin. So there's definitely an argument to be made. Like that was an impressive run, but it's been an underwhelming, like two out of the 3 years have been, it's been more underwhelming
than. And I understand your point. I was just nitpicking your point. Yeah.
No, 100%.
I
was nitpicking
your point. Because I could turn and be say like, what you want last year.
You said there were questions about this team. They were the number one, they were the number five national seed going into the tournament. So they might not have been playing great baseball, but they were in a good position.
No. My point was it wasn't like they were the over – all I was trying to say is they weren't the overwhelming favorite going into that.
Yeah, we definitely –
they were one of the best teams. They sat at one for most of the year. Yeah. But I just think, like, it's inexcusable for them to be playing this poorly. But, like, I don't know. Tennessee had a generational offense and has had a bunch of – they had first-round picks on the mound. They had Chase Burns. They had Dolander. It's really hard to win a national championship, I guess, is what I'm saying. So it's tough to knock you if you do it.
To discredit that.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Any closing thoughts before we get out of here?
But they need to be better. This is embarrassing. It's embarrassing that they're that bad.
Did I just hear a go Tigers? Is that what he said?
Go Tigers. Can't wait to talk. Closing thoughts. Can't wait to talk about LSU on the preview pod this weekend.
Who do they got next weekend?
I don't even know. I've stopped looking.
Fair. As you should, because this team is not playing. Again, maybe they get going, but we said that we said that back-to-back weekends. Like, would you be surprised if they sweep Vanderbilt? They get beat up. Would you be surprised if they sweep Tennessee? No, they get beat up. So now we're going to say, would you be surprised if they win a game this weekend? Yes, and they're going to sweep. So, all right. Well, thank you to our listeners for tuning in, as that will conclude our episode for today. Make sure you're subscribing to the podcast on all podcast platforms, including Apple Pods, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. We post episodes weekly, always hitting your feed at 7 a.m. sharp. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at BacksideGB, Instagram at BacksideGroundBalls, and TikTok at BacksideGroundBall. And most importantly, make sure you're sharing with five friends. We'll see you next time on the Backside Ground Balls podcast.